We look at what bike-friendly means to Wisconsin communities on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As new funding for bike trail projects flows into communities, it's a good time to take stock and assess what will happen in coming years to improve mobility for bikers and walkers. Wisconsin is home to 24 bike-friendly communities. That's according to the latest data from the League of American Bicyclists. And that includes Dane County and Stevens Point. Share your experience out on trails, commuting, what you want prioritized. 800-642-1234. Chris James is senior landscape architect for Dane County. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Good morning. We also have Joel Lemke with us, board president of the Green Circle Trail in Stevens Point. That's a 27-mile scenic loop connecting to other trails as well. Joel, welcome to you.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And Joel, let's start with you and start with the Green Circle Trail in Point. Tell us what makes it so special.
Well, I think a lot of what makes the trail special is just the different attractions that you see when you're on it. It, you know, as you mentioned, it's a 27-mile trail in and around the Stevens Point area. Good for biking, hiking, walking, sightseeing, even bird watching, things like that. It hits our major flagship parks. If anybody is familiar with like Iverson, Buchholz, Pifner Park, some great riverfront scenery, both in the more developed part of town near downtown on the Wisconsin River, as well as the Plover River, where it gets to a really undeveloped area of Stevens Point without any development around.
It also, I was going to say, it also connects to like 45 miles of other trails. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of other trails in the area, some rails to trails conversions, some ski trails, things like that around the community.
And so, Chris James, Bike Friendly America evaluated Dane County way back in the spring of 2016, indicating it as a bike-friendly community, getting a bronze on that report card. How have you seen bikeability change in the county in more recent years?
I think it's just continued to grow. The appetite never ends in Dane County and Madison. Bicycling is incredibly popular. I would say for Dane County parks, we always have at least 4, if not more, regional bike trail initiatives in some form of planning or development. And I think Dane County now is probably getting closer to 40 miles of our own trails, and there's easily over another 80 miles in the county through the other municipalities.
You can go a long way.
you can. And a lot of our trails connect into the state trail network, too. So it's just an incredible system, both for recreation and transportation.
They recommended that Dane County set up an active bicycle advisory committee. Is there anything like this going on?
There has been several over the past years since that. The Madison MPO, the planning organization, had an advisory committee. And there's been a couple other groups that have also started that as well, that do advocacy for us and support us in grants and other ways like that.
Do you feel like bikers are being heard, that that they have a seat at the table?
There's no doubt about it. And I think the evidence of that is our county board and county executive are extremely supportive of the bike trail network. Every year we have literally millions of dollars in our capital budget for planning and development of regional trails. And I think that's really the proof that the bikers are being heard.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Chris James, senior landscape architect for Dane County. Joel Lemke is here, board president of the Green Circle Trail in Stevens Point, as we check in on trail developments, bike commuting, biking for recreation, and what's going on in your community. 800-642-1234. Joel, for Stevens Point, the Green Circle Trail seems like much more of a grassroots endeavor that started back in the 80s. How do you get that community buy-in? How do you work with the city and county?
Yeah, there's some really strong relationships between the city and county. The Schmeekly Reserve as well, which is a great facility here in Stevens Point, part of the university, and it serves as our trailhead. And we all work together just to you know, there's some maintenance obviously on the trail that happens every year, quite a bit of maintenance on those 27 miles, because a lot of the trail is more of a gravel type surface, because we try to get off the road everywhere we can.
And so how is the trail maintained? I mean, who takes the lead on that?
Yeah, ultimately, it's the Green Circle. Okay. There are portions where there's some maintenance items done by the city and county entities, but the cost is borne by the Green Circle Trail, and that's all covered through donations. It's 100% donation-funded organization.
It always has been, and it seems like this really grassroots ability for a group to take a lead on saying, this is important to us and our community, let's make it happen. Do you feel that type of energy happening in Stevens Point?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, just a couple of years ago when we celebrated officially our 25th year of a trail being opened, there was plenty of effort prior to that, but the official trail opening 25 years ago for a section, and we've had a strong board ever since and a lot of community involvement, and it really is just kind of a gem around here. People seek it out, and locals and those who aren't local, a lot of use every year.
I want to pose this same question to both of you about gravel versus paved surfaces. And Chris James, you first, you know, as you approach trail discussions, what is the preference there for gravel or paved?
From my perspective, paved wins hands down because, one, it's much easier to maintain. We find we can get about 10 years out of a paved trail before it has to be resurfaced, which is really low maintenance. Gravel trails tend to wash out more and they have vegetation that tries to encroach. And I think the riders and the walkers and the joggers just prefer the pavement also because it's a much more uniform and constant surface.
And so for those multiple bike trails in planning and development stages, you steer toward paved. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yep, all the time.
Okay. And how about you, Joel Lemke, in terms of your trail? It sounds like gravel is the preference.
Well, it is for what the Green Circle Trail maintains. There are a lot of sections of the trail that go through parks, and through those sections, it's often paved. But a very good percentage of it is more of a gravel surface. And we've got pretty sandy soils around here, mm-hmm. so the water doesn't tend to be too big of an issue. Where it is, we use more of a limestone than the gravel to make sure it doesn't wash out. And I think we just find that it provides a good alternative. You feel a little more off the beaten path, if you will, on a surface like that. But I think both do a good job.
It sounds like you also have a mix because some of the trail is on city streets. Is that right?
That's right. There's a few areas that are a little challenging as far as how we'd otherwise cross, say, maybe a busy street in town or something. So we do vary off of the trails onto some city streets for several blocks here and there, and then where we can dive back into the woods or along the river or something like that.
We're talking about biking on the morning show. We have Joel Lemke in Stevens Point, Green Circle Trail president, and that 27-mile loop. Dane County landscape architect Chris James talking about the priorities in his county. They stay with us on bike trails, the routes, the challenges in their respective Wisconsin communities. You can join in on trail maintenance, trail investment, mobility, what matters to you on a bike, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how to create bike-friendly communities and what efforts are underway around you here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal government is encouraging projects that enhance biking and walking to cut down on air pollution. The State Transportation Department identifies 14 projects in its Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Program that runs through 2026. These projects total about $24 million. Several involve bike trails. You can join in on trail access, your experience biking, what Wisconsin needs to do here. 800-642-1234. We have Dane County's landscape architect Chris James and Green Circle Trail President Joel Lemke in Stevens Point. They stay with us. I just mentioned, Chris James, the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Program, and the projects on this list don't affect Dane County, your region of the state, but how do you feel? Are your programs receiving enough funding from local, state, and federal sort resources to do the things you want to do for bike and pedestrian trails?
I think we have been very fortunate to receive a number of federal and state grants over the past 10 years. One project that stands out is the Lower Yahar River Trail on Lake Wabisa, kind of between Madison and McFarland. And we received over $4 million in federal funding for that project. And actually that reduced the county's investment to just a little over a million, which is, that's just incredible. And we've had a number of other state stewardship grants have helped us out as well. So I think we've been pretty lucky that way.
The grants create that trail, but what about maintenance down the road? You have to really make sure that the resources are there to maintain these trails.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And our trail system has really expanded in the last 10 years, especially. A lot of that maintenance is done by parks operations staff. But with that said, we also have a very large volunteer network that helps out. And some of the funding for the state trail pass also funds maintenance for the trail.
How about you, Joel? Stevens Point Green Circle Trail. How have you turned to local, state, federal sources for funding what is very much a community-driven effort?
Yeah, well, I think that we have benefited from some past funding to some degree. But right now, the thing that comes to mind is the fact that there is a community effort here right now, along with the Green Circle's involvement, but really out of the community to apply for a TAP grant, Transportation Alternative Program grant, to actually build a pedestrian bridge over the Plover River immediately off of the Green Circle Trail. And that will provide another route to the east side of Interstate 39 here in a way that doesn't involve, going through four lanes of traffic and things like that. So, yeah, we're always looking for ways to benefit in that way. And I think that we've got a good project that will likely get some funding here.
And so when might you find out about whether that goes through?
Pretty soon, I believe. I think that we've got a pretty good feeling that it's going to get some funding. Just a matter of timing. So it might be one of those things where it rolls to next year again, just because of some work that needs to be done. But yeah, I think it's promising.
Do you feel like you have any of those challenges, those bottlenecks where there is a lot of lanes of traffic and you're trying to figure out how do we put a trail here? Or how do we get people across this safely? When you come up with those roadblocks, what do you do, Joel?
Well, I guess that's kind of the background of the whole thing, right, is how do we get off the roads? How do we get people around our community and not be reliant on those paved surfaces? That's kind of the main focus of the Green Circle Trail. But yeah, there are those challenges still where, you have to cross a river, you have to cross an interstate, or you have to cross a major arterial. And really, it just comes down to working with the local jurisdictions to do it safely.
And Joel, you are public utilities director for Stevens Point, your day job, so to speak. How does that filter into, how does the trail board work with local governments? And how do you see your work in public utilities factoring into what you're doing with the Green Circle Trail?
Yeah, on the surface, not a lot. But, oddly, the trail, some of the nice areas along the Plover River actually do go through municipal property where our municipal well field and the municipal airport are adjacent to them. And the reason the property is there to go through is because those two exist. So there's a lot of really cooperative work between the Green Circle Trail and the municipalities. And that includes the city of Stevens Point, Portage County, and we even get out into the village of Whiting along with Plover to our south a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the tools of the trade, Chris James. As an architect, I was reading about a new virtual tool that could help planners choose the best places to install bike lanes in cities, and it involves using sensors and a handlebar camera and really gathering a lot of data in order to make some of the best decisions in designing these trails. How do you use technology to help you in designing bike lanes and trails?
Well, I think one of the tools we use most is GIS information, and that really helps us to identify maybe environmentally sensitive areas or cultural features that may be out there, wetlands. And we've been doing that for quite a while, but one thing that's just started to come up more and more is it's an application called Streetlight that actually does like average daily traffic counts, and it kind of will do an analysis of roadways for their suitability for bicycle traffic. And we recently just used that on a project by Capitol Springs Centennial State Park to take a look at a roadway that we were using to connect into an off-road path. So I would say with the technology now, it's definitely easier and faster to come to some conclusions. And that's been a huge benefit in planning bike trails.
And so you don't have to string something across the road to get a count, you know, for an inter. I mean, I suppose that was more old school.
Yeah, there's that. That was pretty long ago. But the other thing is it helps us to really look, like take a first cut at looking at a whole region where a suitable route might fit best, rather than hiring another consultant to do those traffic counts for us. You can get down to where you're trying to go pretty fast now with the data that's out there online.
Hmm. Chris James, Senior Landscape Architect, Dane County, Joel Lemke here, Board President of the Green Circle Trail in Stevens Point, as we discuss what it means to be a bike-friendly community, projects they're working on, and the grassroots efforts to keep these trails going. Join in at 800-642-1234. Joel, how do you keep track of how many people are using the trail and the Green Circle Trail, and at what points where, you know, more use is happening, where less use is happening? Do you have a good estimation of that?
Yeah, we do. And I was just counting as we were going through here for, it looks like we have about 9, 10, 11, 12, maybe trail counters. We have a really interesting program where an intern at the Schmeekly Reserve does a trail counting report for us quarterly. We meet quarterly. And I was looking at one from 2020 here, where I think a lot of people in the state who are involved in trail systems saw their uses increase, if they are measuring, in fact. And
pandemic-related.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw a nearly 65% increase in trail usage during that time. And so, you know, we have our busier parts of the trail that'll see at sometimes 600 people per day, and even the lesser used ones will be almost 300 in those busy times. So yeah, we use some infrared type trail counters.
Chris James, did you see pandemic related boosts to the use of the trails at all? What did you find?
Off the charts.
Oh, my goodness.
We were amazed. I believe overall our park use went from 2 million to 4 million visitors a year, which for a county park system is pretty significant. And our trail systems, however hard we try to build them for capacity to 12 foot width or whatever they are, they were still, especially on weekends and off times, congested. It would be the word for it, I guess. And we're going to be interested going into the future if that trend continues. I'm sure we picked up some new users, and that's always great.
Because you want them to come back. You want them to appreciate that and come back again and again to get to make use of these trails.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all connected. Trails are great for both transportation, recreation. People use them for wildlife observation and overall just a greater appreciation of the natural environment.
Mm. Joel, how do you keep people coming back again and again to using Green Circle Trail? What about reuse?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that there's a ton of effort into making that specific goal, one of ours. We're mm-hmm. just trying to provide the trail that people want to use. First time users, excuse me, reusers. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's a real variety. If you want to see our riverfront through downtown parks, it's there. And on the other end, it's a totally different experience when you get down by the Plover River and you're there. Mm. And so there's just a lot of variety, and it's really usable. Have some good maps out there, and we have some signs along the trail, some really neat large kiosks that give you an idea of where you are in the community, where you're going, and even some notes that are specific to that part of the community. Mm.
Joel, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
And Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joel Lemke, Board President of the Green Circle Trail in Stevens Point. Chris James, Senior Landscape Architect for Dane County. We heard from Rodney in Madison, called in, said, I want to thank all those bike advocates. My son went to school in the rain this morning and couldn't keep him from riding his bike. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Now, 4 years ago, an explosion at the Husky Energy oil refinery in Superior injured dozens of workers and forced a temporary evacuation of city residents. Now, documents obtained by WPR from federal regulators, they shed new light on what refinery officials knew leading up to the blast. As Danielle Kading reports, the refinery knew about erosion on a key piece of equipment a decade before the explosion.
The Superior Oil Refinery has operated in the city since 1950. Now construction is ongoing behind me, just a few miles from Lake Superior. The refinery's towers and tanks are still here, but there are cranes and contractors working on rebuilding the plant after an explosion 4 years ago. Most of the workers were on break when the explosion hit. Even so, three dozen people reported injuries that range from spinal fractures to minor cuts and bruises. Attorney Kyle Finley represents nine contractors who are suing the refinery for medical costs and lost wages.
The impact it had, the hard hats being blown off, people knocked off scaffolding. I mean, it's a very traumatic event.
That night, refinery manager Colin Shady told reporters that the blast took place as the facility was shutting down for maintenance.
Throughout 2013, we did a similar event where we shut the entire refinery down. We go inside every vessel and we check everything for mechanical integrity.
The U.S. Chemical Safety Board said a worn valve likely caused the blast by allowing air to flow backwards inside a unit that's important for producing gasoline. And an investigation by federal labor regulators found the refinery could have prevented the explosion if it had properly maintained critical equipment. WPR obtained more than 1,300 pages of documents from that investigation by the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. They reveal the refinery knew about problems with erosion on that key valve a decade before the explosion. OSHA found the worn valve had been repaired during the refinery's last shutdown in 2013, and the one before that had been rebuilt in 2008. Holes in the valve were found during both shutdowns, and refinery workers knew the valve could leak because of erosion. In the final hours before the blast, workers reported hearing two booms from inside a refinery control room. Documents show the plant's operators and supervisors didn't fully investigate what had caused them. Finley says evidence shows things were going wrong for a long time.
When you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
OSHA found the refinery should have inspected the valve more frequently and changed it out sooner. And the agency found no documented inspections of repairs to that valve by the refinery during the last two shutdowns. Operator logs also showed the worn valve was malfunctioning in the days leading up to the explosion. Plant managers had changed its shutdown procedure just a day before the incident and hadn't given operators adequate training. Jordan Barab served as OSHA's assistant deputy secretary during the Obama administration. He says it's not uncommon to see procedures and training that don't keep up with changes at refineries.
Rewriting procedures and retraining workers and all that kind of stuff is not something that directly leads to profit. It's easy to cut corners there.
Barab says it's important to have strong involvement from workers or unions to promote safety. WPR reached out to 9 contract companies on site that day and 4 local union representatives, but none agreed to speak publicly. Atticus Larson is a refinery electrician and member of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 420. In late 2018, Larson said during a chemical safety board meeting in Superior that no price can be put on safety.
Did people think safety was expensive before? Look what it costs us now. We need to start using the most up-to-date safety standards that have been in the industry for years. The most important thing, period, is for everyone to go home safely after every shift to their family.
Last year, Husky merged with Cenovus Energy in a roughly $5 billion deal. In an earnings call last week, the company said the $1.2 billion rebuild has the refinery on track to resume normal operations early next year. A Cenovus spokesperson said in a statement that the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment. That includes new slide valves. The lawsuit from contractors who were caught in the 2018 explosion is still ongoing. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now to payday loans. Ohio, Virginia, other states have overhauled their regulations. Not the case here in Wisconsin, which has fewer safeguards. Opponents say these loans prey on people who live paycheck to paycheck, trapping low-income Americans in particular in a cycle of debt. The Pew Charitable Trusts has been looking at this issue for years, detailing what states are modeling through reforms. You can share payday loan experiences, questions, 800-642-1234. Alex Horowitz is Principal Officer for Pew's Consumer Finance Project. Alex, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So in Wisconsin, you found that people pay about $395 in fees on a $500 loan over the course of 4 months of payback. The average interest rate there, 338%. So how do we stack up to other states?
Wisconsin is one of only 7 states in the U.S. that does not cap interest rates for payday loans. And the effect of that is that the same payday loan companies that operate throughout the country charge Wisconsin borrowers more than they charge elsewhere.
So let's step back for a moment. How does a payday loan work? Where do you get one?
Sure. So there are 2 requirements for getting a payday loan, a checking account and an income, because the borrower's checking account on payday is their collateral for the loan. And there are payday loan stores and online payday lenders that make these small loans to consumers throughout the country. And we see that about 12 million Americans use payday loans in a given year with an average loan size of about $375. When the loan comes due, then the borrower makes payments directly out of their checking account, and the lender has access to the borrower's checking account to make sure they get repaid. Those loans can either be repaid in full on the borrower's next payday or in installments over time.
Oh, so if they have access to your bank account, then that they can continue to, well, they can certainly get the money out of there. But so if the payday lender has access to your account, then, and you don't have enough money in your account at the time that lender tries to withdraw, now you have overdraft charges coming from your bank on top of whatever charges the lender will layer on for your payment bouncing. That could easily snowball.
That's right. And that's why the default rates on payday loans are manageable for lenders, even though borrowers have low credit scores, because the lender can take the money directly out of the borrower's checking account because they're either holding a paper check or they have electronic authorization to take the money out. And so borrowers end up making payments on the loan, even if they can't really afford to, because the payday lender is first in line to get paid ahead of rent, utilities, car payments, food, or other necessities.
Can a payday lender garnish wages?
That varies state to state. Some companies don't do it as a matter of policy. Others do try to garnish wages, but there's a lot of variation depending on the company and the state.
But what about privacy here? Is information like sent to employers by the payday lender? How much privacy does the loan applicant have?
That's rare that an employer would find out about a payday loan. But we see that the bigger consequence for households is that many borrowers end up paying more in fees than they originally got in credit. And that can make it very difficult to make ends meet because the average payday loan borrower only earns about $1,200 per pay period.
I want to go back to something you said, that you found that payday lenders tend to charge the maximum amount for loans under state law and only charge lower rates when they're required to do so. So is that what you found in Wisconsin, payday lenders charging the maximum amount?
Wisconsin, because Wisconsin has no rate limits for loans, we see that lenders charge higher prices there. Mm. So for example, borrowing from the same payday loan company, a similar borrower taking the same amount pays almost four times more in Wisconsin than they do in Colorado, even though it's the same size loan for the same term from the same companies.
Wow. So there are a bunch of states, including our neighbor Illinois, that have strong laws that bar payday lenders from operating. In some of these states, they've had these restrictions in place for years. I'm thinking Arkansas. I remember when that was instituted. Are these states, are these places any worse off not allowing an industry to operate within their borders?
No, the evidence suggests that borrowers make other choices, even though they're tough choices to make, such as borrowing from family and friends, delaying paying bills, working out payment plans. And recently, some banks have started offering small loans at much lower prices. And those cost typically about 15 times less than a payday loan, even though they're available to customers with low credit scores. So that's a much more affordable option that is likely to become more prevalent over time since more banks are announcing these small loans each month.
But the Community Financial Services Association of America, they say that banks and credit unions and credit card companies are generally unwilling to offer these small dollar loans to people because they don't view these loans, these products as profitable. Is that the case, or what do you find?
That used to be true, and that was true as recently as a few years ago. But there's been a sea change where banks have taken a new look at this area, and they have federal regulatory guidance giving them a clear pathway to offer these loans. And so we've seen Bank of America, U.S. Bank, and Huntington Bank enter the market with new small loans accessible to customers with low credit scores in recent years. And four other top 12 banks have announced they are joining the market later this year.
Alex Horowitz guides research for Pew's Consumer Finance Project as we look at what it's like for Wisconsin residents to turn to small dollar loans or these payday loans, what the consequences are. Join in sharing your experience, your questions about payday lending, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Alex Horowitz here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about payday loans, legislative regulations that some states are enacting, what you see. The payday lending industry says it has stepped up to provide vital access to credit when traditional banks, credit unions have not in the past. You can join in on payday lending, 800-642-1234. Alex Horowitz, principal officer with Pew's Consumer Finance Project, with us for about nine more minutes. So, Alex, you know, last year, lawmakers in Wisconsin proposed capping payday loan interest rates at 36%. That legislation, it failed to gain traction. Why do some lawmakers oppose capping interest rates?
Well, with an interest rate cap like that, there is a reduction in access. So that's the kind of cap that Illinois has. But we see that with caps that are somewhat higher than that, like Ohio's or that in Colorado, Virginia, Hawaii, then payday loans are still widely available, but at much lower prices. So there's been sort of this false choice between consumer safeguards or access to credit when those states have wanted to have both, and they've achieved that successfully.
But, you know, you look at some other states exceeding 600% for that interest rate in Nevada, Idaho. I was looking at Texas. You know, what are these states thinking with an interest rate so high?
So Wisconsin still does have loans that are made at interest rates over 500 and 600%, but there's been a shift toward payday installment loans in Wisconsin, loans paid back over time. The average interest rate in Wisconsin last year for single payment loans due back on the borrower's next payday and then borrowed repeatedly was 537%. That was the average in Wisconsin last year. So it's not that Wisconsin doesn't have these interest rates over 500 and 600%, but it's that they've shifted mostly to payday installment loans that are often larger, longer, have more time to repay, but have very few consumer protections and no interest rate limits. So Wisconsin's prices are still among the highest in the country. They just have a shift toward payday installment loans, which usually have APRs in the 300s, annual percentage rates in the 300s, instead of single payment loans that are more prevalent in states like Nevada and Idaho.
So how is the interest rate then estimated? How do they figure that out? How does the lender figure that out?
Oh, there's federal law guiding this under the Truth in Lending Act. So the lender doesn't have to make any decisions about how to calculate the interest rate. They simply do it based on federal law using 1 year as the time period to figure out how much it would cost to borrow a loan for a year. So there isn't any decision-making really involved since Congress has provided clear law on that.
How do you tell if a payday lender is licensed to do business in your state? Because you mentioned before that these lenders may operate one way in one state, another way in another. And, you know, if you can get these online as well, how do you know that they're valid?
Online payday lenders are licensed too. So Wisconsin provides licenses to online payday lenders and to storefront payday lenders. But if the lender doesn't have a state license, then that's a different story. And to do that, the loan isn't governed by state law, although there are very few consumer protections in place in Wisconsin for loans that are provided by a state licensed lender or one who is not. But the Department of Justice has cracked down on payday loans that are made without licenses, which used to be more prevalent about 9 or 10 years ago.
Talking with Alex Horowitz of Pew's Consumer Finance Project, and we're discussing payday lending, a new report from Pew. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Christy in Stevens Point. Christy, what's your perspective?
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling. I think this is a great topic. I wanted to offer the insight that I think that these types of loans have a big impact on individuals with ADHD because they have problems with their executive functioning. It often affects their ability to manage money, and it also makes them more impulsive. And, you know, these types of loans can seem like a really easy way to get out of a tough financial situation, but really it ends up putting them into a debt spiral that can last for years and years.
Christy, do you have experience with this?
Yes. So I, in my 20s, had turned to payday loans, just like the basic ones where it was like a couple hundred dollars and then you pay it back. But because of the interest, it ends up being like the payment that you're making towards the loan ends up being too much to afford the other things that you need to be paying. So then you end up borrowing that money back.
Mm. How did you get out from under it?
Honestly, just literally yesterday, I've reached a point where my income is enough that I was qualified for a personal loan at a percentage rate that's high to most people, but is not like the hundreds of percents that we're just talking about. So I was able to take that personal loan and apply it and pay off, the installment loans. And hopefully now with the things that I've learned, because I was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, I have a budget app now, and I have a whole plan, and I'm hoping that this is the end of it.
Hopefully walk away from it. Christy, thank you for sharing your story. Let's get insight here from Alex. What do you hear?
So that's a great point about age that Christy started using those in her 20s. We see that payday loan usage is highest among 25 to 34-year-olds, and it's slightly higher among women than men. And it's significantly higher among people who are parents than people who are not. And with last year's child tax credit in place, there was a drop in payday loan usage because people had access to that child tax credit. And so we saw fewer people who were taking out payday loans during that time.
Interesting. Let's bring in Ken now in Eau Claire. Ken, hi.
Hi, good morning to both of you. I'm calling because we started a program here in Eau Claire. I don't know if people are familiar with a group called JONA, Joining Our Neighbors, Advancing Hope, usually working for systemic change and trying to get laws passed to do things like hold down payday lending rates. We found out that with loopholes and legislative people not willing to do that, that we thought, let's do it the other way around. We'll try to compete with payday lenders. So we started a group 10 years ago, charging 0% interest rate, no finance charge. Basically, we meet people at where they're at, and we give them financial help to get them out of the payday loan. They pay us back. It's not charity. We expect to be paid back. Since that time, we've made over $80,000 in loans and helped out 100 and some individuals get out of their payday loans. We go and pay it off for them, and then they pay us back at a rate that they can definitely build into their budget and afford. So this has been where we're hoping that this idea could spread to different communities. And it's all volunteer. Donations have come in way beyond what we have thought they would. And people have paid us back at a rate that most people said there's no way it would get paid back. But
wow.
Our idea is to
yes.
Use,
and Ken, we're short on time. What a story here. Alex, have you seen this elsewhere?
Absolutely. There have been nonprofit efforts that have been successful in helping a small number of households around the country. The problem is so large, with 12 million Americans using these annually, that the path to scale has been through changing state laws. And in the states that have reformed payday lending, their residents have saved over $500 million in the time that they've passed those reforms. So opportunities like this through nonprofits are certainly terrific in helping households. But achieving scale requires statewide reform.
Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Alex Horowitz is Principal Officer for the Consumer Finance Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. We have a link to Pew's latest report on payday loans. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead is hemp production on a comeback. We examine the hemp industry in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.